love, our sweat leaves us to our tears. More, more, more love make us cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown. All the flame burning bright. Who perilous night.
From WPFW News, I'm Sue Goodwin, news director at WPFW, and with me today is reporter and producer Noah Portner. This is usually when you would be listening to We the People with David Whetstone, and he will return on September 3rd. Today, we bring you special programming on the genocide in Gaza. We begin with today's news from Gaza, where Israel is on the verge of a military occupation of Gaza City. Starting today, Israel will begin calling up tens of thousands of reservists for an expected assault on Gaza City. Such an assault will bring more death and destruction to Gaza, where over 62,000 residents have been killed and over 150,000 injured since October 7th, 2023. During this hour, we're going to hear from some of the people who could no longer sit idly by and let this genocide unfold. Joining us from Toronto is Mesa Hawash, a founding leader of Doctors Against Genocide. Thank you for joining us, Mesa.
Thank you so much for having me, Sue.
I appreciate the work you're doing, and I know our listeners will want to hear much more about it, so let's dig right in. Tell us when and why this group came together.
Thank you. So Doctors Against Genocide is an organization that actually was founded well before October 7th. And the reason why is the two co-founders of Doctors Against Genocide, Dr. Karama Kamerli Hawash and Dr. Nidal Jabour, both Palestinian. We have been seeing the escalation in attacks in the West Bank. If you recall, the settlers, where they started burning villages, and there was a lot of assault on Palestinians in the West Bank. This also coincided with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh from Al Jazeera. And all that escalation has led to Dr. Karama and Nidal to anticipate that a genocide was underway actually in the West Bank. And so when October 7th happened and the counterattack by Israel on Gaza, Doctors Against Genocide was officially founded as an organization late October 2023. So that's when it was registered.
You know, I in reading, in preparation, I read somewhere how you chose the name.
Yes.
Because back then, 2 years ago, genocide, we weren't hearing it. Hardly as much as we're hearing it now.
Yeah.
So tell me.
Yeah. So, you know, it was basically a function of deep concern and a lot of research actually on the stages of genocide. If you look at the stages of genocide, there's documented stages, and we were seeing that the West Bank was in stage four. So, right, so we were seeing dehumanization already happening. We were seeing the blockades, the mass killings and the targeting of civilians that was, you know, accelerating. And we were seeing those narrative by the Israeli officials literally dehumanizing Palestinians. So the word genocide was chosen. And when we first launched, I remember a lot of organizations were like, don't use the word genocide, you know, say something like Doctors for Humanity or Doctors with Justice or things like that. But we want it to be intentional, deliberate, non-apologetic, especially that this organization is Palestinian-led. So, you know, I'm Palestinian, Nidal, Karama, all Palestinian, and there was no way we were going to sugarcoat the truth and use a different term to cover for something that is so insidious like genocide. So the word was chosen, and of course we were attacked. We were, you know, by several individuals, and but two years in, you know, sadly the genocide continues, and now we're seeing many organizations come to the realization what we knew intrinsically as Palestinians, that we were undergoing a genocide for years and years and years since 1948 and even before then, which really all to say that every genocide scholar should really center the people who are impacted by genocide. So when we say it's genocide, people should listen to us, not the other way around.
That's very important. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, help us understand from a health perspective. Your organization is made up of doctors and therapists and administrators, every possible path in the health profession. You yourself are a physical mm-hmm. therapist. Tell us from a health perspective, with a goal to heal, what are you seeing in Gaza? And of course, it's almost too big to describe, but let's begin by talking about malnutrition and starvation.
Yeah. Where do we begin? Maybe a little bit of a preface why, you know, Dr. Agin Genocide is actually, it plays an important role in the health community, period, and why we are growing in numbers all the time is because we know that there's a huge gap in medical advocacy. You know, doctors, healthcare workers, they're simply not trained to advocate. They're trained to see patients, they're trained to prescribe medication, they're trained to actually, to be honest, make profit for the organizations they work for. That's the Western medical system. But when it comes to advocating, when it comes to understanding the root cause and the determinants of healthcare, and we saw a huge gap. And this is why we focus from day one on mobilizing healthcare workers, educating about advocacy, that they have a role to play. You know, 20% of the U.S. probably is working somehow in healthcare. So that's a huge segment of the society and a huge segment that's actually respected by the entire society. So we wanted to tap into that latent capacity to advocate and to provide education and to mobilize to change policy.
Let me interject there. Do you find resistance at all? I mean, these are folks, as you mentioned, they're working for universities, they're working for corporations, a number of different entities. Do they feel reluctant? Do you sense a reluctance to be outspoken?
So there's a lot of repression, as you know, in organizations. There's a lot of doxing. There is a lot of attempts to silence the voices of, you know, healthcare workers who speak out. And we are seeing actually an increase in the intensity of this kind of repression, because now we're growing, right? So a lot of people are speaking out. A lot of people are just tired and sick of genocide. And actually, that's one of our campaigns. I'll talk about it.
Please do. Hashtag sick
from genocide.
Genocide, yes.
You know, ultimately, what genocide is, not only is it a global and a massive healthcare crisis, it also is an attack on our nervous system. Because, you know, think about it. You're trained to heal. You're trained to actually bring health to a society, but you feel so disempowered and you can't even speak out. So that moral injury, that creates what we call a sick from genocide symptom. And we've had, so yes, there's repression, but we're also seeing a growing number of healthcare workers, healthcare professionals who are joining this movement, and they're literally saying no to genocide and sick from genocide. You know, Gaza, it's important to understand that the attack on Gaza has not just happened after October 7th. So this, we're talking about like years and years and years in the making, even before the you know, Gaza was under a siege. Calories were counted per capita. So there was a restriction of food, a restriction of the ability of the people in Gaza to grow their food, to have, you know, a viable economy. There was all sorts of restrictions designed to maintain this 2.4 million population under siege and in the worst conditions. So all these conditions leading to genocide were there. And then the new variable that was added after October 7 is that massive, massive attack, massive killing. You know, we started seeing thousands of people killed in one day at the beginning, right? And we continue to see an average of 100, 150 a day of mass killings. Because Gaza is a small area and you know, Israel controls all access to Gaza, you know, from the sea, from the, you know, from the land, from all directions, it was very easy to starve Gaza. And actually, what's also dangerous is that it's very easy to starve the West Bank. So I want people to think about the long-term, you know, plan of Israel. So, and I want to explain to the audience that starvation doesn't just happen overnight. You know, people didn't just wake up one day and they were starved. Starvation is a process that starts obviously with limiting, you know, what's coming in, to completely, completely blocking all aid, you know, what happened in late March. And, but it also first started with discrediting the UNRWA. The UNRWA that was very effective at delivering food. That was the first thing. They attacked UNRWA. They made it, they, you know, they funded UNRWA.
You should make clear, that's United Nations.
Relief.
Right.
Agency. So that was right. The agency that was responsible, because the majority of Gaza is refugee camps. You're talking about 80% of people in Gaza that are refugees. So that's number one. So you dismantle the infrastructure that was designed, and that was actually created because Israel occupied Palestine, because Israel created a refugee problem. So, you know, start to think about the systemic problem here. And then they dismantle the UNRWA. And they dismantle, they start attacking, you know, organizations that were delivering aid. And then all of a sudden, blockade, complete blockade. So you have miles and miles and miles of trucks sitting at the border waiting to come in with food that can feed Gaza. However, Israel chose to completely shut down. So starvation happens in stages. And those stages were well designed, well orchestrated, well engineered as part of the plan to not only conduct a genocide, but also empty Gaza of its population, because that's the ultimate goal, because they want the land. So in terms of malnutrition, I think right now we're at 250 reported cases of people killed because of starvation. Obviously, who is the most impacted? The children, the pregnant mothers, the nursing mothers, and people with disabilities. And also, they introduced a system that's not only illegal, but it's also a death trap. So the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, that is actually US funded and led, I want to make sure that people know that the US is participating in this, shifted from a system that was well, you know, designed to feed 2.4 million to only four aid distribution points. Those aid distribution points is where people go and try to get aid and get shot. And so, you know, I just want to explain to the audience that this is like a multi-layered complicity on top of complicity, and it's a systemic attempt at, you know, rendering this population, obviously, you know, just killing and creating long-term health impacts. And so in terms of the stages of starvation, you know, what happens to the human body, and just to kind of illustrate that this is not something that happens overnight, right? So you're talking about weeks and weeks and weeks in the making. So obviously the first few days, you know, you see the immediate effects because the body starts using all the stored carbohydrates, you know, that for energy. So that's usually within 24 hours, human bodies, like, they don't keep as much carbs in the system. And then, you know, after that, it immediately starts to use the fats, which is basically storage for fuel. And this is where people start feeling intense hunger, fatigue, dizziness. And if you can remember, you know, it was reported a lot of people were falling right in the middle of the roads, because this is where, you know, the dizziness was kind of taking hold. In 1 to 2 weeks, the body starts, you know, after you finish using your fat storage, you start attacking muscle tissue. This includes your heart. This includes your organs that are supposed to keep your body running. Your immune system becomes weak. You start experiencing, and we're seeing this on the news, you know, the swelling because of protein loss, low blood pressure, difficulty regulating body temperatures, severe weakness, confusion, and people start, again, like we see people falling in the streets. And then 3+ weeks, this is where it becomes actually irreversible, right? Because, you know, you start seeing severe protein and nutrition, malnutrition, organ failures, livers, kidneys, heart, your brain, which actually consumes a lot of energy, starts to shut down, and people become, you know, delirious, unconscious, immobile, right? So this is basically the physical manifestation of starvation. But what I want to emphasize is that it does not happen overnight. This is systemic. And you know, and then the other thing too is when you start bringing food in, there is this thing called the refeeding syndrome. You can't just give people carbs. They will actually literally die. So you have to use expertise to, you know, carefully bring people to health. But the long-term impact on people from starvation is, you know, there's documented data on long-term impacts, you know, on nursing mothers, on children. The children are being born now with deformities. They're some with like no organs, right? So because, you know, of what we are creating for these people, and of course children.
Well, and I think it's really important that you say these long-term effects of malnutrition and starvation, these are going to be playing out in a country that's been devastated. That
this is an attack on generations.
Are there grocery stores? Are there, you know? So that is certainly another issue your organization is taking up. But I need to give you some time to tell us, what is it that Doctors Against Genocide hopes to achieve?
Well, we want to end the genocide, right? So we're doctors against genocide.
Of course. Forgive me. But what are your short-term goals right now?
Yes, of course. So, you know, Doctors Against Genocide, we want to mobilize the healthcare workers, right? So mobilizing the healthcare workers to use their voice and influence. So, you know, some of the actions we do, regular actions, is advocacy on the Capitol Hill. So every month, we bring in doctors, we bring in healthcare workers, and we provided our Congress members with a prescription to end genocide. Basically, here are the clinical manifestations of what's happening in Gaza. This is U.S. complicity, and this is a prescription to end our complicity. So we've done this in the U.S., in Canada. We host healthcare workers and doctors from Gaza every week. In a 3-hour-long webinar every Sunday, and everybody's invited to attend. Actually, if you'd like the link, I can drop it. Everybody is invited to attend and listen to the voices from Gaza. So we bring these voices from Gaza, and these are doctors, these are pediatricians, these are medics, paramedics, and they tell us what's happening. They give us the exact truth of what's happening in Gaza, and it's absolutely gut-wrenching and heartbreaking to see, because we also worry about them, because a lot of the healthcare workers are attacked. You know, over 1,500 healthcare workers have been killed. And so we want to offer our platform to the people impacted by genocide to share their truth, to share their stories, and to use this as testimony, obviously, that we can take to not only the politicians, but potentially to the ICC, the ICJ, to use as evidence for these atrocities and these crimes. We are holding our second annual conference this year in September. we're bringing healthcare workers, we're bringing scholars, genocide scholars, to, again, to teach and educate and mobilize and to create actions. We've done many, many campaigns, one of which, as I mentioned, is Sick from Genocide, where we've held pop-up clinics in front of hospitals where, you know, healthcare workers came and supported, and people came and actually talked to us about those moral injuries, these psychological impact of witnessing genocide, but also being suppressed and not being able to do something about it. And, you know, we continue to drive these. So we are hoping to bring in as many healthcare workers into this conversation, as many mobilizations, so that collectively, you know, we can not only expose the truth, but also hold our governments accountable and eventually make a difference, you know, make a difference on the policy, because our complicity is, to be honest, like, it's disgraceful. It's horrible.
Are patients able to join your organization? Is there room for patients?
From Gaza?
Yeah.
You know, everybody, our organization is open to everyone. We have medical students that, you know, join our organization. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that we have actually aid projects that we have launched. Oh. For example, one of our key projects is the rebuilding of Al-Shifa Hospital, because, you know, all the hospitals were bombarded and attacked. And so this is an underway project. We've also launched an aid initiative where part of it is feeding communities, providing essential foods, again, as a prevention of starvation. We are supporting medical students through tuition, also feeding, because everybody's starving, and other initiatives across Gaza, in different communities within Gaza. So we have a fundraising campaign to support all of these things. You know, patients, obviously, because we're all healthcare workers, you know, a lot of our healthcare workers provide their expertise, you know, medical expertise to support, and we support organizations that are trying to evacuate some of these patients to get treatment. We're not actually participating ourselves in the evacuations, but we are supportive of that work. And some of our doctors have treated children and patients who have been evacuated. So we are in touch and in contact with these patients all the time, their parents, their families. I personally was in Palestine in the West Bank last month, and you can see the preparation for genocide in the West Bank. It's actually quite scary. I spent a few days at the Balata refugee camp, you know, with the children, with the healthcare workers. And there's a huge need for, you know, supporting the healthcare in the refugee camps in the West Bank as well, and the villages, you know, everywhere.
And, you know, you brought up children several times when talking about starvation and how they are so vulnerable, but their mental health. I hate to ask, but what do you observe? And I'm thinking about the young children, but also the teenagers.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, what can I tell you? you know, this is just, it's hard to describe, and it's heartbreaking because, you know, the children, you have the highest number of child amputees in the world in Gaza. You have at least 40,000 orphans now in Gaza. So children who have lost all their parents, everybody. And a lot of these children are injured. And displacement, imagine displacement. Imagine losing your home, losing your family, having no place to live, losing all your relatives and having to fend for yourself. This is not, what's happening in Gaza is not childhood. Childhood is completely obliterated, sadly. You know, we are hearing children say, why didn't I die with my family? There is an absolute state of continuous trauma, and it's not like PTSD. It's not, you know, it is chronic trauma that you're subjected to day in, day out. You have the sound of drones all the time, 24/7. You have drones, and it's very noisy, right? And you live in a tent. If you're lucky, Because some people don't have even that, because the displacement continues, right? They're always displaced. And at any point, you are attacking mothers. I don't know what the word to describe it, but it's a dire psychological impact. I wouldn't even call it depression. I wouldn't even call it, like, I mean, it's something beyond trauma at this point. It's like ongoing, continuous, and it's unrelenting. And if we don't do anything about it,
right?
Again, trauma has long-term impact. Starvation has long-term impact. Displacement, disintegrating of the society, right? Structure, the family unit. I mean,
Mesa, I hate to cut you off because I could talk with you for hours. However, I do want to give you some time now to tell our listeners how to find out more about Doctors Against Genocide. What are some actions that might be coming up that they could even participate in?
Thank you. So we are easily found on doctorsagainstgenocide.org. Please go to our website. You can see a lot of our fundraising initiatives are there. A lot of our campaigns are there. Specifically, if you're a healthcare worker or interested in supporting healthcare, please join us in September at the second annual conference that we're holding at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, September 20th to 21st. Our Instagram is a great way to learn about our campaigns. We have a very active Instagram account. Of course, we are shadow banned all the time by Meta. So please support us and follow us. And our campaigns are shared on the website. If you go to the website and join us as a member, you don't have to be a healthcare worker, but you can be a healthcare advocate. We will make sure that we email you about our webinars, all our upcoming events and actions, which includes Days of Action on the Hill. These are open to anyone. You don't have to be a healthcare worker. Again, you can be a supporter of healthcare and you can join us. And we provide a lot of toolkits, a lot of training on healthcare that people can, and healthcare advocacy that can people learn and build their toolkit, their language and vocabulary around advocacy.
We have 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. What would you say to a healthcare professional who's listening now that has never heard of what you're doing or really considered healthcare advocacy? What do you want to say to them before you leave?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I would ask them, how does witnessing a genocide feel to you as a healthcare worker? And if you haven't actually spoken out, why not? And the answer to this question often enough, sadly, is that, you know, healthcare workers are just not trained. They don't think they have agency. They don't think they have empowerment to do this. And I want to remind everyone that you have agency. You have the power. You just need to find the right community that's supportive, like Doctors Against Genocide. So if you're curious, join us. Go to the website. We have a lot of tools. So I would ask them and invite them to learn, to open their hearts, open their minds, and really start practicing the essence of medicine. The essence of medicine is to protect and preserve life. And if we're not advocating against something so horrific as genocide, then what are we doing? Are we just part of this profit-making machine, or are we actually healers? So that's the question we ask every healthcare worker, every healthcare organization, every association: what are you waiting for? You know, health. You know, genocide is a healthcare crisis, is a massive global health emergency. So everybody should be mobilized. It's everybody's business to say something and do something, and everybody has agency. So please use your power and use your agency.
Well, it has been wonderful to talk with you. You are inspiring. I appreciate the work you do. I appreciate the time you spent with us. So thank you again. That is Mesa Hawash, founding leader of Doctors Against Genocide. And we'll be back in just a moment with another committed person to making a difference in Gaza. We'll hear about prosthetics for Palestine. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Sue Goodwin. Yeah. Stand for something to fall for anything. I'm sick. But it's game time. Hey, the world's on fire. We don't own the water, y'all. Inmates hire for.
building and you can't afford groceries and debt in your feelings. And you know how the West thinks. It's all about the West Banks. Call a ceasefire, then start annexing the West Bank.
Good morning, everyone. This is Noah Portner from WPFW News, and we're covering David Whetstone's normal slot. That's the show We the People. Fear not, Whetstone will be back on September 3rd, but today we are doing something a little different with special coverage of Palestine. Before that musical break was Mesa Hawash from Doctors Against Genocide talking to my colleague Sue Goodwin. Now we continue our special coverage in the topic of healthcare, with a project to deliver prosthetic limbs to injured Palestinians. During the course of WPFW's coverage of the Gaza War, we often focus on deaths, but the scope of the conflict means that it affects far more than the 63,000 or so people who have lost their lives. That's fear, starvation, and above all, injury, which will leave an imprint on millions of people, just like Dr. Hawash was discussing earlier. We overlook these victims of war often, focusing on military or deceased, but not today. Today, we're joined by Nikhil Delahaye of Prosthetics for Palestine. Nikhil, are you there?
Yes. Hi. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Happy to have you. Why don't you start by briefly introducing yourself and your organization? Who are you? What's your mission?
Hi. So my name is Nikhil Delahaye. I am the quality director for Prosthetics for Palestine and the Healing Hands Fund, both of which are a conjunction working towards sort of addressing the upwards of 10,000 plus amputees in Gaza. Physicians for Palestine saw in 2024 that there was a massive need, given that Gaza now has the highest proportion of limb deficient individuals on the planet. So our work came in to be able to look at where we could help to be able to bolster infrastructure on the ground. And my job specifically with Prosthetics for Palestine and the Healing Hands Fund is to be able to ensure that whatever prosthetics we deliver are delivered with adequate quality measures that are WHO the standards, specifically ISO 13826. So I wrote a quality document to be able to ensure that whatever prosthetics we give is following a quality plan with possible follow-up, and then also making measurements and data collection so that we can ensure that just because it's a war zone, they still deserve extremely quality medical care and prosthetics follow-up. So I know that was a bit of a long intro, but I wanted to make sure to set the stage.
No, that's good. It sounds your expertise is very technical and detailed. Did most people who worked for this organization work in healthcare or with prosthetics before?
Yeah, so mostly I just wanted to highlight, like, we're a coalition of cross-sector volunteer professionals. So a lot of people, almost all of us, have full-time jobs. And after those full-time jobs, we go on, some of us on the West Coast, East Coast, around the world, to be able to figure out what can we do to be able to give back and help. We have people who are experienced pediatrics, experienced prosthetists, experienced healthcare workers. So really, we run the wide gamut. Myself, I have a bachelor's in public health from the University of Miami and a master's in health administration also from the University of Miami. So my expertise comes in sort of the overall sort of not quite regulatory, but the technical and quality assurance angles. But we're really a wide gamut of volunteers, a bunch of people from a bunch of different places. But the thing that unites us all is that none of us are doing this for the money. We're doing this because we have the skill set and we want to be able to get back.
Great. I want to do, while we're talking, a deeper dive into this issue. But before, maybe you could tell me about what prompted you to take this interest in Palestine. Was there a specific moment or you just felt it weighing on you?
So for me, the prosthetics in Palestine have been something that have both been a through current throughout my life. When I was very, very young, about 10 or 11, I remember reading about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and I was hearing one story about it that didn't seem as comprehensive even then. I was like, this is really leaving out the Palestinian perspective. So I did my own research, and that's really like looking into books. I went to the library. That was in the era of a lot of forums, being able to talk to Palestinians about their experience. So as a kid, I was like, this is something that's really important to me. High school, we were studying Israel-Palestine. I was in the IB program. So for our extended essay, I'm doing it Israel-Palestine in our history class, might as well do my own paper. So the paper that I wrote was for during the first and second Intifada, comparing the impact of religious and secular resistance organizations. And it was about 50 something pages. I hope to be able to publish it one day. But the thing that really like made me imagine like, oh, okay, here's the societal impact of this, is that I got a zero on that paper. They gave me a zero on that paper. If anyone from South Lakes is listening, I still got my IB diploma, but they gave me a zero on that paper, and I did it to standards and everything. And then I went into college and I was like, okay, that's a learning experience. Additionally, sort of in 2012, I suffered a severe head injury. And through there, I realized that like, okay, I really want to make sure that I can help in some way or capacity with medical technology. And I really fell in love with prosthetics. I fell in love with prosthetics in terms of what they allowed to be able to give people, fell in love with prosthetics and what they allowed people to be able to express themselves. And also just the autonomy it gave people, especially at a time when due to a head injury, I felt like I didn't have a lot of autonomy. So in all my courses, I started a club at high school. All my courses were geared towards prosthetics. I started with biomedical engineering before I switched over to public health. I was gearing my entire life towards prosthetics to the point where my undergrad thesis was focused on delivering upper limb different Syrian refugees prosthetics to Syrian refugees in Turkey. I wasn't able to implement that due to funding and the situation changing, but that was a lot of my sort of experience. Was like I had working with a nonprofit to be able to design an initiative to be able to give prosthetics to Syrian refugees in Turkey. Fast forward to grad school, and after grad school, I had tried to launch a prosthetics company, wasn't able to get the funding. I moved back to DC and I was like, my life's work is in prosthetics. My life's work is in being able to give back to Palestine. I just need to make sure that I have the opportunity to be able to do so. Fast forward to about 6-7 months ago, I saw an Instagram post from Prosthetics for Palestine. And I reached out, let them know like, hey, here's my thesis, here's my experience, here's everything I've worked on. And it was off to the races. And truly every single day I wake up knowing that I'm doing my life's work. This is what I've always wanted to do, is be able to give back to Palestine in some tangible way, and also be able to help push 3D printed prosthetics and work with prosthetics. So I truly every day wake up and feel blessed that I get to do what I do. And I truly wake up every day feeling grateful for the other like-minded professionals, but in healthcare and the many organizations we collaborate with who are also on that same mission, who are very much in the same boat of, hey, if you have the skill set, it's not about being the perfect activist or the perfect something. If you have something, you can get back right now. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that gets me up every morning, is like, I am giving back right now, given everything that's going on, everything I can, with all of my experiences that have led me to this point. And it's sort of an alignment of everything that I've cared about since I was little.
Right. It seems like you almost have independent interest in Palestine and prosthetics, but you've deliberately fused them together because you see there's the need for that. That is great. And it's great to hear from you about why you got into this in the first place. Maybe you could help us get a firmer grasp on what your organization does and what the scope is. How many people are you treating? Are you aiming to treat? And what's the demand like in Palestine?
So let me first start with the demand. So really, right now, there's an estimation of about 10,000 amputees at minimum in Gaza right now. So as a portion of that, that's a good chunk of those are children. And as it's been confirmed by World Health Organization and many other organizations, the highest proportion of child amputees in the world is in Gaza. And it is way more than the current prosthetic infrastructure in Gaza can serve. So basically, Prosthetics for Palestine, in partnership with a bunch of other organizations, such as the Healing Hands Fund, Airlink, ANIRA, Limber, and other Palestinian health organizations, we're all working together to be able to facilitate safe delivery of high-quality prosthetics and work towards building the infrastructure in Palestine. So the kind of X factor that differentiates our project is a lot of other prosthetics projects have just been able to like drop off a ton of prosthetics, not necessarily customize them, and just be able to just give as many prosthetics as possible, which is an understandable like approach. But because of the nature of prosthetics and them needing to be refitted, and also the way people's stumps change, that ends up to where a lot of prosthetics end up hurting Palestinians long term. And before, a lot of prosthetics are just being used as firewood. So what we're really trying to do is build a sustainable solution that is building up the infrastructure that exists. And we're working in alignment with Palestinian prosthetic and orthotic professionals for training, education, and collaboration. So a lot of our work is being able to facilitate in terms of, hey, how can we make sure to get the prosthetics that are in the right place? How can we make sure to get the prosthetics that are using this 3D printed technology in the right place? How do we make sure to train people with the new technology as well? Because the thing I also want to make clear that a lot of media and a lot of discussions about Palestine tend to leave out is that the images and the perception that people often see of Palestine is that life has stopped. It's just fully apocalyptic. And in my mind, while in efforts to be able to communicate the gravity of the depravity that's happened and that's been inflicted upon the Palestinian people, that also removes their agency. Because there are people that we talk to, that we work with, who have to walk 3+ hours every morning to get to work, but they're still doing it. So the infrastructure, while a lot of it is ruined in Gaza, there are still people who are getting up every single day trying to do their best to help. And that is something that I feel like is important for us as Americans to understand, is that this is not just a like population of people that has no autonomy and agency. They have autonomy, they have agency, and they have dignity as well, which is why from our perspective, we want to be able to bolster that with the resources and connections that we have. So to speak to the specific work that we're doing a lot. So right now we're in the process of doing our initial pilot, which is trying to fit 5 patients with the limber unileg. That is the main prosthetic we're using, is the limber unileg. Right now we are in the process, we're about to hit 5. So we are currently in the fitting process, being able to fit a bunch of patients, get the right mold for the prosthetic. And then we're in the process of trying to be able to then move through the next stages of the program. My job is being able to measure the different outcomes of that to see, okay, how is it fitting? If it's the slower leg, how is your walk pattern? How's your gait pattern? Is it causing any chafing? Is it causing any pain? And then working with professionals on the ground to see if we need to make any adjustments or accessories. A lot of what we're doing on top of that is also logistical coordination to ensure that everything can be able to still like work, and that the prosthetics that we're be able to print are like in the right quality. So I will say a lot of what we're doing, we're starting small so we can make sure that we can get it in a good like path and a good pathway, and a sustainable pathway that we can scale effectively. And that's my job, is to ensure that whatever we do, we can train, we can replicate, and be able to scale.
I see. So you're in charge of quality assurance mostly.
Yes, quality assurance. I do some other work with the innovations. I kind of bounce around all over the place at project management, innovations, but my whole thing is I want to make sure the effort people are doing is tracked and that it's also scalable as well, because my vision, I'm not just thinking the next 6 months, I'm thinking 1 year, 2 years, 3 years with this project, 5 years, decade, to be able to make it so that we can really deliver a sustainable solution for prosthetics, not just in Gaza, but the West Bank as well.
I mean, based on everything you just said, you said there's maybe 10,000 people who need these prosthetic limbs, arms or legs. And if you're only able to reach maybe a few dozen people, maybe a few hundred, if everything goes well for the next year or two, how do you decide who gets this treatment? This seems like a major concern.
So a lot of what we do is we defer to the organizations on the ground that are able to select and find patients. And a lot of that's due to, okay, what is the nature of the injury? What is it? Because right now we're only doing below the knee. amputations. So because that's what we're starting with due to our Unileg collaboration, we want to be able to address other types of amputations as well, but we're starting with one that we know we can address well, and then we're going to scale from there. So really it's first identifying, are they below the knee? What's the nature of the stump? What's the nature of the injury? Have they tried prosthetics before? Really just going through the standard prosthetist sort of checklist with the organizations on the ground to be able to ensure that the patients we do get will have a positive reaction with the prosthetic, just because it's a 3D printed prosthetic. It's designed to be scalable. But we also want to make sure it doesn't just end up being something that ends up hurting them. So it's a lot of that is using our in-house prosthetists as well, in addition to the prosthetists that we talk to that are on the ground. And additionally, I've been able to talk to some orthopedic surgeons about their process to see like what the crossover is and what their processes are. And obviously, as the situation in Gaza has become more desperate, that's harder. But my goal is to ensure that really, whatever patients we do get, even if it's an absolutely less than ideal scenario, we can still make sure they have quality outcomes and we can track and measure those outcomes. Even though it's going to be difficult to do so, it's still worth doing for the benefit of the Palestinian people. Mm.
Sounds like this infrastructure, then you need people who work there, EMTs on the ground, you need specialists like you in America. Has your organization run into any language or cultural barriers trying to coordinate all of these healthcare people?
Definitely. One of the things I like, and much of what I said about like the dignity and the autonomy of the Palestinian people is something that when you work with nonprofits, it's easy to see populations you're helping a certain way. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to see populations you're helping in a way that sort of removes their autonomy and removes, okay, I'm going to come help, I'm going to come in and solve the problem. But being able to work with Palestinians on the ground as collaborators has helped and helped differentiate us a lot in terms of being able to have communication, being able to work them into our workflows, and like understanding that due to time differences, like some meeting times are going to have to be adjusted. But really, really focusing on that collaboration mindset has helped. And of course, there's going to be miscommunication, but we have a good amount of people on our team who speak Arabic. I myself am trying to learn Arabic just because at this point, it's really necessary for the work I'm trying to do. But that's something we've really focused on, is that cultural appreciation and that focus on really ensuring that we view them as colleagues, and because we are colleagues, we're all in this together. And that's really important for us to always sort of pay attention to.
Well, it seems like your organization is working to humanize these people in two ways, right? You're working with them side by side, and also just the idea of having prosthetics, giving them to people who have been injured. We often hear about prosthetics, and you can even donate on your website, right? A entire arm or a leg. Prosthetics, we hear, are getting better and better. What makes them better, and what components make them so expensive?
So that's a multi-pronged question, and one that I'm glad you asked, because the popular image of prosthetics can widely vary, whether it be from a plastic with a hook to a full myoelectric prosthetic. The gamut of what it is defined as a prosthetic has really changed, but the difficulty, as always with everything American healthcare, is access. So a lot of prosthetic initiatives that we're focusing on now is the advent of 3D printing due to materials, due to material availability, due to material biocompatibility as well. There's a lot of ways we can ensure that, due to whether it be doing a quick scan through a phone instead of having to do a full like plastic and plaster, or doing a combination of that process, there's a lot of innovations happening to be able to make prosthetics more customized for individuals. Because realistically, prosthetics, because human beings are in flux, prosthetics have to be sort of in flux as well. They have to adjust because the stump can change, things can change after a while. So there's really a follow-up process. A prosthetic, the popular view of prosthetics and prosthetic initiatives, that once you give someone a prosthetic, then the initiative is finished. That is something that we're, and myself and a lot of my work has been trying to change, is that it is not just a simple acute procedure, just give someone a prosthetic and then it's done. There needs to be follow-up, there needs to be tests, there's wear and tear from where it is. And also the stump where it's attached to is going to change. So you really, prosthetics have to be looked at as sort of a longer term sort of health investment, and many in the field do. But in terms of the popular view of prosthetics, to from everything from a regular hook to a cybernetic arm, and that we see in science fiction a lot, both gamuts of those require adjustment, customizability, and then also rejection is a factor as well. People can have psychological rejection to a prosthetic. People can have physical rejection to a prosthetic. It's not necessarily a one size fits all. And a lot of the work that I was specifically focused on back in grad school and college was the psychosocial aspects of prosthetics, in terms of, do when I look down at this arm or this leg, is this mine? Does this feel like mine? And those are questions that are really important. And as the field gets better and gets more comprehensive, we're getting better at being able to answer those questions. 3D printing for customizability, 3D printing for different styles. Like, there's a whole lot that we can do from the medical to the cosmetic angle. But again, the affordability comes into the materials, distribution, and also the labor required. There aren't a lot of prosthetists. There aren't a lot of prosthetists in Palestine specifically. There aren't a lot of prosthetists in general. And so and also because so many need to be made, the logistics of transporting material and getting material in and out definitely becomes a factor as well. But I will say, in the time that I've been aware of the field, it has been evolving significantly. But I do challenge listeners to be able to look more into prosthetics and don't think of them just as a one-size-fits-all immediate solution. Think of it as a long-term solution that is going to require multiple touch points for clinical professionals.
Right. Well, this next question should definitely touch on the long-termism. What do you see prosthetics for Palestine doing, or do you see them having a role in post-war Gaza? It seems like in order to facilitate these transitions, it'll have to be constant. If there was a ceasefire, mercifully called in the next few days, would you want to keep upscaling, want to keep being on the ground?
So my comprehensive vision, and this is something that our board and all of our collaborators are aligned to as well, is that we are able to not only scale operations, but also ensure that we can have a local printing solution, so that in terms of shipping, that's something that we're able to be more agile with. A lot of this is still obviously in flux, but as many parameters that we can get in terms of being able to ensure that if we need to make a quick turnaround, it's a lot easier than shipping possibly from somewhere else. But one of the biggest things is also with the medical infrastructure of Gaza and the medical infrastructure of the West Bank. Being able to collaborate with international organizations and the World Health Organization to not only rebuild but bolster health resources in Palestine would be something that is I'd be personally interested in, and I know members of the team are interested in, specifically in terms of prosthetics coverage. And in terms of moving forward, really just being able to ensure that the professionals that are on the ground who have been doing the work the whole time can be able to get the support internationally that they need. And that also being able to ensure that materials and things that people don't necessarily think about when it comes to medical materials, but for prosthetics specifically, end up being really important, can have really a way easier way of being able to integrate into those workflows. We've had to adjust and pivot a lot due to material constraints. And my kudos to our entire team and everyone we've been working with on the ground to be able to do that. And a lot of that is just due to the nature of this project. You have to be able to pivot. You have to be able to think outside the box. You have to be able to think about new ways of doing things that never been done before. And we've been able to do that in order to ensure to what we can get to where we can go. I would like to ensure that we can keep doing that and also make those replicable to a bunch of other places.
I see. That is a great vision for the future. Right now, what is causing... We got maybe 5 minutes left here, but I think this is an important question to clear. Oh. You're on mute. Okay, I'll go. Awesome. I was wondering about the what sort of strikes lead to these injuries. Is this mostly missile or drone strikes by the IDF? Are there other injuries that are common, even just accidents, or is it almost all just deliberate drone strikes?
So really, it can be a whole gamut, unfortunately. So whether it be to falling debris, whether it be to some deliberate sniper attacks, whether it be to drone strikes, whether it be to drone attacks, really so many things can lead to traumatic amputation. And my huge thanks and respect goes out to the orthopedic surgeons who are on the ground, who have to make these truly impossible choices, and with less than stellar material, with sometimes no anesthetic, to be able to radically change the course of someone's life due to something that they had no fault in. And I'm just really, the gamut of these injuries and some of the people we've been able to talk to really just, they'll blow your mind. But the thing I always want to bring it back to, there are people on the ground every single day who wake up to try to help, to try to save, to try to save lives, to try to prevent limbs from becoming infected, to try to make some sort of next path forward for all of these people that are so unjustly wounded. And as we move forward, it's going to be really, really important to understand that they're not superheroes. These aren't just people who were born differently and decided to be able to, like, oh, they were ordained to be able to help. These are everyday people who woke up and are choosing to be able to do what they can to help. And that is something that I feel like every single person in this country especially needs to understand, is that there's nothing inherent in doing the right thing. There's nothing inherent in being the person who can help in the right instance. It just requires doing it, and doing it even when scared, doing it when nervous, doing it when there's so many other things that are a factor that make you nervous or worried to be able to get involved. There's people that I'm talking to that are our colleagues every single day who wake up and it's like, how can I help? Here's my skill set. Here's what I do. And they're regular people just like you and me, and they deserve support.
I like this idea of putting your expertise towards, you know, this mission, something like justice, something you care about. Your expertise amazingly fits with this crisis, right? You're a prosthetics, like everyone else in your organization. Maybe you're a journalist or a doctor. What would you say to normal people or everyday people who think maybe their expertise doesn't line up in a way that's super obvious to help? How would you urge them to get involved?
I'm really glad you asked me this. This is something I tell to everyone. And this is something that, especially in DC right now, myself being in DC, we are on the recipient of one side of the imperial boomerang in terms of being under military occupation. What I will say is, I guarantee you, and I want everyone to listen to this, I guarantee you, no matter what skill set you have, there's something you can do to help, whether that's cooking a meal for someone, whether that's watching someone's kids, whether that's being able to provide a link to a document that you know about, whether that's being able to provide insight on a topic you know about, whether that's knowing a professor, knowing a person. There are so many individual skill sets that you have. Even if you just knit a sweater for someone, that helps. But an immediate way you can help with us is if you look at pfpal.org, also healinghandsfund.org. There's ways for us to get involved. We're always looking for volunteers. Definitely.